On this week's 51%, we look at male versus female voices in political advertising, pay attention to equal pay.
If the wage gap were to close, the average family could afford another 1.6 years worth of groceries.
Hear about gender bias in science and learn about the Mother's Day movement. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. As Election Day approaches, political advertising will begin to saturate radio and television, and a new study says the chances are male voices will be used far more often than female voices to try to get your vote. Patricia Strock, Deputy Director of Research at the Rockefeller Institute of Government and Associate Professor of Political Science and Public Administration and Policy at the University at Albany, says a study she authored found that in the congressional races of 2012 and 2014, male voices were used in political ads 63% of the time, female voices 28% of the time, while 9% of the candidates used both female and male voices. She spoke with 51%'s Brian Shields.
We don't actually know why they do this. We have some ideas about it, but we do find that when the issue that the ad is about is a feminine issue, candidates are more likely to use a woman's voice. We find that when the Republicans are running, they're more likely to use a woman's voice. When there are women in the target audience, then they're more likely to use a woman's voice. But we don't find that men's voices, even though they dominate political advertising, they're not more effective.
What about Republicans? They're more likely to use a woman's voice. Why do you think that's true?
We don't actually know why that's true. I mean, there's theories about they're softening up, so Republicans have a particular image, and that image is being tough and hard, and so a woman's voice can kind of soften them up. We do know that men running for office are more likely to use women's voices, too, so it might just be a contrast to what we're expecting to hear from them.
And Democrats did not perceive a woman's voice to be any more credible than did Republicans.
No.
So there's not a real credibility difference there.
No, so that's the interesting finding, is that there's not a huge difference in credibility. And it's not that men have an advantage in their voices. In fact, women's voices can be more effective. So we don't know why we see this disproportionate use of men's voices.
Female voiceovers were more often used when the topic was determined to be feminine. Does that mean a woman's issue? What do you mean a feminine issue?
So we had a hard time figuring out what feminine issues are, and we looked at surveys like most important issues that they asked men and women about. And when women disproportionately said an issue was more important to them than men, then we coded that as a woman's issue. And these kinds of issues are things like we might expect, child care, Social Security, health care, but it's also things like security. They're more concerned about security than men are.
I guess an attack ad is really in the eyes of the beholder, but if an ad is negative, it's considered an attack ad. Would a woman's voice be used more often, or would it be a man's voice?
It would be a woman's voice, and I think that, again, is to soften it up when you're having a very harsh message. You want to soften up the presentation of it.
You want to soften it up, but you also want to be tough, though, don't you?
Right. Yeah. And so you can do both at the same time. You can put forward a very tough message, a very tough attack, a very tough contrast ad, which says, look how much better I am than my opponent. And at the same time, you have a woman's voice deliver it, so it comes across as a little softer and not so harsh.
Women's voices were more common when the ad was about a candidate's characteristics as
yes.
opposed to policy. What does that tell you?
That's like an attack ad. That's a less positive ad. You're going against, you're talking about somebody personally. And so, again, that would be interpreted to mean they're softening up the presentation of what could be a really harsh ad.
These were congressional races, so I assume maybe foreign policy came up. If a foreign policy issue, ISIS, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, would a man or a woman be used if it's a foreign policy rather than a domestic policy ad?
So I think I'm not sure which men or women were more likely to say terror was important to them.
Mm-hmm.
Security at home definitely was considered a feminine issue in our study.
You took all this information. What are you going to do with it now? What does this tell you? What do you want maybe candidates to learn? What do you want your students to learn, or your media students perhaps when they're looking at campaign ads?
I think what we take away from this is that even though you see very, very sophisticated campaigns and you see very sophisticated campaign ads, the use of a man's or woman's voice is dates right back to the kind of stereotypes we had in the 1960s about who's more effective or who's available to do these ads. And so I wish, or I hope, that candidates and campaigns and people watching them pay more attention to the kinds of messages that they're hearing and who's voicing those messages, and maybe more parody in ads.
Finally, do you think the voice is more important than the image? We think back to the nuclear war ad in 1964, Lyndon Johnson against Barry Goldwater with the girl pulling the daisy petals off and the countdown and the mushroom cloud. That was a very stark image. And maybe the voice itself wasn't quite as stark as the image. What's more important, the picture or the sound?
I think the picture is very important, and it's part of a total message. So you'll get a picture, you'll get words, and then you'll get the voice that often accompanies those. And so sometimes the package can be very coherent, and sometimes, as we're just talking about, you can mix it up to present a really negative attack and kind of soften that up so it doesn't seem so bad. So I think thinking about the packaging of the whole ad isn't a good way to think about it.
That was Deputy Director of Research at the Rockefeller Institute of Government, Patricia Strock, talking about a study she authored on male versus female voices in political advertising. April 12th was Equal Pay Day. That date symbolizes how far into the year women must work to catch up to what men were paid the year before, and it's based on national figures. Nationally, women who are employed full-time year-round are paid, on average, 79 cents for every dollar paid to men. The National Partnership for Women and Families released for Equal Pay Day an analysis of the gender wage gap for all 50 states and the District of Columbia. Vicky Shabo is the National Partnership's vice president. She says the study finds that Washington, D.C. came in best in the nation for having the smallest wage gap at 10 cents. New York came in second with 13 cents.
New York's wage gap is smaller than the United States. In New York, women who work full-time year-round are paid 87 cents for every dollar paid to men, amounting to an annual average median wage gap of about $6,800.
The study uses data from the U.S. Census Bureau. Shabo says if the gap in New York were eliminated, each woman who holds a full-time year-round job in the state could afford to buy food for one more year, pay for mortgage and utilities for three more months, or pay rent for nearly six more months. The study shows that in Connecticut, the wage gap is 19 cents, in Massachusetts, 18 cents, in New Hampshire, 24 cents, and in Vermont, 16 cents. Shabo says passing the Paycheck Fairness Act is one pillar for achieving pay equity. The legislation would close loopholes in the Equal Pay Act, help to break patterns of pay discrimination, and establish stronger workplace protections for women. The bill was introduced by Connecticut Democratic Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro. Shabo also promotes another focus.
But the other thing that we need to do is create more family-friendly policies in workplaces.
Policies, she says, such as paid sick days, paid family and medical leave, and legislation to raise the minimum wage. New York is ahead of the curve, having just passed legislation for paid family leave and raising the minimum wage. The Independent Women's Forum calls itself the group at the forefront of debunking the wage gap statistic and so-called war on women. IWF officials say Equal Pay Day is the day that liberal feminists, progressive groups, and their allies in Washington perpetuate the idea that the economy is a battle between the sexes. IWF released its own report called Working for Women, A Modern Agenda for Improving Women's Lives, and it focuses on job creation, workplace flexibility, and returning resources to individual women. Managing Director Carrie Lucas opposes a federal paid family leave policy.
Rather than creating a one-size-fits-all compensation system and rules that would impact the compensation packages of all workers, we want to try to make it to give people more options. And one way this report calls for doing that is to make it easier for people to save to provide for their own periods of leave.
She suggests that policymakers allow for the creation of personal care accounts to save pre-tax dollars that could be used for family leave. The National Partnership Shabo says equal pay is an issue that affects families, and the presidential candidate should be talking more about it.
If the wage gap were to close, the average family could afford another 1.6 years worth of groceries, another 7 months of mortgage and utility payments, or 11 more months of rent, or 9 more years of birth control. So this has real economic consequences, and the candidates across the aisle should absolutely be talking about this as a core issue of economic importance for families and for the nation's economy overall.
Nationwide, Shabo points out the gap is larger for African American women and Latinas, who are paid 60 cents and 55 cents respectively for every dollar paid to white non-Hispanic men. Meanwhile, MTV's Look Different anti-bias campaign unleashed a nationwide protest of the gender pay gap with the creation of a certain tool, as discussed in this video.
That's why we created the 79% Work Clock. The 79% Work Clock reminds you and your coworkers of a simple fact. After a certain point in time, women aren't being paid. When a woman hears its chime, she might as well go home.
And that chime, for the average 9-to-5 workday, sounds at 3:20 p.m. MTV's campaign unveiled an online hub, 79%clock.com, featuring the 79% calculator to help individuals find the correct time setting for their personal work clocks based on their hours and race. Also on Equal Pay Day, President Obama designated a new national monument in Washington, D.C. to honor the movement for women's equality. The Belmont Paul Women's Equality National Monument will protect the iconic house that has served as the headquarters for the National Women's Party since 1929. The designation not only will permanently protect one of the oldest standing houses near the U.S. Capitol, but help preserve an archival collection that documents the history, strategies, tactics, and accomplishments of the movement to secure women's suffrage and equal rights. Now we'll hear from women scientists about the biases they face in their daily work lives. Caitlin Esch from Philosophy Talk brings us the story.
Sometimes gender bias can be subtle, like it was for Jennifer Raymond, a neuroscientist at Stanford.
One time I was speaking in a retreat, and one of my senior male colleagues was introducing the speaker before me, who happened to be a trainee, and went on and on about his scientific talent and the brilliance of his project. And then the same moderator introduced me by saying I was a mother.
Or it could be overt, as it was for women of a slightly older generation. MIT biologist Nancy Hopkins recalls the time she met Francis Crick, the man who co-discovered the structure of DNA. She was a young student at Harvard.
And the door flew open, and standing in the doorway, there was Francis Crick. Recognized him at once. I looked up, and he zoomed across the room, put his hands on my breast, and said, "What are you working on?" And I thought, whoa, this is an awkward situation right here. Well, what do I do here? I've got to get out of this without embarrassing this man.
Hopkins says she was incredibly embarrassed, but it never occurred to her that groping was cause for complaint, so she didn't tell anyone. Later, when Hopkins started her own lab in the 1970s, she started noticing that when women scientists made important discoveries, they weren't as referenced or as valued as their male colleagues.
So you just kept trying harder and harder and harder. And I think it took me 20 years of watching other women and realizing it didn't matter how hard you tried, you couldn't be taken as an equal no matter what you discovered.
And this revelation was a huge blow to Hopkins. She actually thought about leaving science altogether.
It was like trying to fill a bucket that had a hole in the bottom of it. You know, you kept doing more and more work, but the work kept running out the bottom of the bucket.
Hopkins says things have changed a lot since then, but there's still the nagging problem of the unconscious bias. Skidmore College psychologist Corinne Moss-Rakusin has actually documented this.
We were really curious to see whether male and female faculty members, if they were presented with an equivalently qualified male and female science student, would they view those students equally? Would they mentor them equally? Would they evaluate them equally?
So in 2012, Moss-Rakusin and her team recruited 130 faculty members at colleges and universities all over the country. They sent them applications from a student who was applying to be a lab manager. Everything in the application was exactly the same, except that half the participants got applications from a female and half got applications from a male. The results were pretty surprising.
When the student is described as female, faculty members rate her as less competent than the identical male student. They're less likely to mentor her, less likely to hire her for a lab manager position, and if they do hire her, they pay her about $4,000 per year less on average than, again, the identical male student.
And this bias wasn't just coming from male faculty. The female faculty members had the same unconscious bias. Stanford professor Jennifer Raymond says the first step toward dealing with the problem is admitting it.
We had made a lot of progress in the 80s and 90s, And then in the last 15 years or so, progress has leveled off. So when I did the calculation in my field in neuroscience, to get to 50-50 gender equity at the faculty level, if we kept going at the rate we're going now, we wouldn't reach 50-50 until sometime in the 22nd century.
Raymond says this isn't just about fairness. We're facing huge problems that science can fix: climate change, food shortages, disease. And we need to draw from the full scientific talent pool, male and female. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Vivienne Pellet has her sights set on becoming a female ship captain on the Congo River. And she's studying at the shipping school in Kinshasa, and once she's qualified, she wants to encourage other women to follow her lead. The story is from DW correspondent Thomas Klein, brought to you by Eunice Wanjiru.
Every morning at 7 o'clock sharp, students muster at the shipping school in Kinshasa. Vivienne Pellet has been here for 2.5 years. Studying to be a ship's captain. She is one of four women in her class.
Women are important for navigation. I like to say that if a woman can rule a country, she can also steer a ship.
Vivienne Pellet is keen to take on responsibility. Female captains are a rare sight on the Congo River. Training requires full concentration. Vivienne practices with ship models. This is important because the Congo River has plenty of traps. Tree trunks, sandbanks. There's often not much room to navigate. The students also learn English for communication on board. Here they're also taught about materials and ropes.
Everything I do here is really important. Young people often don't like maths. That goes for me too. But here, I've come to realize how important it is, trigonometry and all that. If you want to dock a ship, then there's something you need, and that's trigonometry, of course. So everything here is important for navigation.
Vivienne Pellet uses the little free time to visit her mother, Marceline, who looks after Vivienne's son, Shiloh. The family lives on the shipping school campus. Almost 3 years ago, Vivienne left her home in the Central African Republic and came to Kinshasa. It was a dangerous journey, with the civil war raging in her home country.
For my family, my training is very important because I come from a poor family. I was the one who decided to study until I qualify. It's important because my family should also benefit.
For now, her family supports her, also financially. After the theory lessons, it's time for the students to go on the water. Vivienne and her colleagues have to get a feel for the river's currents. The Congo River is navigable for almost 3,700 kilometers, that's 2,300 miles, making it the world's fifth longest waterway.
As soon as I've finished my studies here, I'd like to go back home and convince young women there to become captains, like me.
Hidden rocks, sharp curves, and river pirates. The Congo holds many dangers. But Vivienne Pellet is not afraid. In 4 years, she plans to complete her training and become the first female ship's captain in the country.
That was Deutsche Welle's Eunice Wanjiru. This week, we bring you another installment of the 51% segment called Force of Nature from Dr. Sharon Ufberg. She is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in Napa Valley, California. She regularly blogs for the Huffington Post. And this week, she interviews Kim Hausman-Athen, who is one of the co-founders of the Mother's Day Movement, an organization dedicated to making a difference for women and their families in the developing world. She also serves on the board of the Anti-Defamation League, and she's a mother of two and the daughter of Eva Hausman, also a co-founder of the Mother's Day Movement. The Mother's Day Movement was formed in 2010 after learning that more than $18 billion is spent in the United States on Mother's Day on items such as cards, gifts, and meals. The Mother's Day Movement asks people to honor their favorite mothers on this special day by making a donation to a designated charity each year. Past beneficiaries helped to educate girls, reduce maternal mortality, and provide access to clean water in impoverished parts of the world. Ufberg asked Athen the impetus for the Mother's Day Movement.
The impetus for the start of the Mother's Day Movement was a book that we all read called Half the Sky by Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudun. In this book, we learned about things such as fistula, which is impacts pregnant women in the developing world where they are going to give birth and have obstructed labors, don't have access to doctors, distance from hospitals, and they end up with holes in the sides of their body, leaking feces. The baby dies in birth, and these women are pariahs in their communities. We learned about sex slavery. We learned about young children being sold to brothels and having to work in brothels to make money. But the book also told us about with a few dollars, a woman can start a business and change her community, help her family, and really can make her whole life better. And with that, just a little bit of opportunity, woman can change everything around her.
I know that as one of the founders, you really were inspired by this notion of how much money was being spent on more trivial items, and that they just gave a small part of that towards one of these unbelievable causes that you describe. I'm just wondering, how you're feeling about just your experience creating this movement, as a woman, as a wife, as a mother, and, how your idea for this Mother Day movement has grown.
Well, as a mother, I thought about what I wanted for Mother's Day, and all I really wanted was for the world to be a better place for my children. And that $18 billion number has grown over the years since we began this, and back then we learned that all 60 million girls who are currently not receiving an education in the world can be educated for that amount of money. So after hearing that, it became something that we had to do to help women and help their children in turn. And as a woman, it was important for me to make a difference in the world. I felt fortunate enough to be able to do that, and that's what I did so that I could model for my children and do good things for the world.
I know it's very special that you do this work with your mother and with two other women, and that you all just volunteer your time. I mean, how did that come about that you all decided to take this project on?
Well, after reading the book and hearing about that astronomical number, we said the book has a call to action. It says, don't just read this book and hear these horrible stories and put it down. It asks you to act. And when we learned about the $18 billion, we said, we want to redefine Mother's Day in our lives and in the lives of people who care about the world. And it's not asking people to not acknowledge your mother on Mother's Day. It's saying, well, instead of a dozen roses, why don't I get you six roses and donate the rest to help a mother in need around the world in the designated charity that we choose for that year.
Can you tell us what charity that you're choosing for 2016 for this coming Mother's Day?
Yes, I can. We are very excited. We have chosen an organization called More Than Me. More Than Me runs an academy, a school, an academy for girls in Liberia that was started in 2009. They have been acknowledged by the president of Liberia as showing best practices, and in fact have been asked by the president to oversee the development of schools across Liberia. But we are focusing on the academy, and unfortunately when Ebola hit in Liberia, the academy was open, and they automatically turned to helping their students and their families battle the Ebola virus and kept them as safe as they could. And in fact, the woman who started it was named Time Magazine's one of the top 100 most important people in 2015 for the work they did with the school and their reaction to Ebola.
Thanks so much for being with us. Again, it's mothersdaymovement.org.
We like to have ambassadors around the country where you reach out to your community and share this idea and help us move the apostrophe to make Mother's Day not just about your mother, but about all mothers in the world.
This is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1396.